This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Join me in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming, we gather here today to celebrate the resurrection of life. What this resurrection means can be and is as varied as the people who go to make up this community. But encompassing them all is the notion that what was dead and useless has been sloughed off and a rebirth has begun. Let us be gentle with ourselves when we are rebirthing, bringing forth that which is new and different from ourselves. Let us find the wisdom to treat ourselves in these moments as we would treat a newborn child, holding our newness gently, rocking it back and forth, and singing lullabies, songs that soothe the soul. And help us, great spirit within, to recognize when others are so engaged, when others are bringing forth from themselves a new way of being, a new way to amplify the glory of the light that surrounds us all. Some of us have figuratively been entombed in the rock hardness of our hearts. May that hardness melt away, and may we emerge from our self-made tombs, renewed with no sense of remorse or regret. The hardened hearts of the past are past. We are new creatures in this moment, and in this moment we celebrate the quite human ability to take flights of fancy and return to earth changed creatures. Bless all those here with the ability to see themselves new again. Give us all the willingness to let go of others so that they may change and grow, and above all, forgiving us for thinking that we've had it all figured out for years. This we pray in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. Your heart will live forever, a resurrection twist. There's a Shinto temple in the southern end of Honshu Island, which is the biggest of the islands that goes to make up Japan. Legend has it that that temple was first built in 4 BC, but probably the 7th century is more like it. I say first built because whenever it was first built, over 2,000 or 1,400 years ago, it has been rebuilt every 20 years since that time. They don't tear down the 20-year-old shrine and build another one. They ritualistically dismantle it. Then on an adjacent lot, they rebuild it from entirely new materials, but following exactly the same ancient plans. Is it the same shrine, the Issei Shrine, or more commonly known in Japan as Jinju, the shrine? Is it the same shrine that exists today that was first built in the 7th century? Or is it only a reproduction of the long-lost original building? Oh, an exact reproduction, no doubt, but last rebuilt in 1993, but still simply a reproduction. In a similar manner, each and every one of our cells in our bodies is refurbished every 7 years. If you're 49 years old, you're lucky to be that young, you've inhabited 7 brand new different bodies. Oh, they were exact reproductions of the old body, but still a reproduction. At the age of 49, if you're lucky enough to have your grandmother still alive, as my wife Viv did when she was 49, then what exactly is it about you that your grandmother loves? In other words, what is it that stayed constant during those seven reproductions? For the people of Japan, the soul of the Issei shrine centers around the fact that each time the shrine is rebuilt, it is built and used as a Shinto shrine, the shrine, Jinju. No rich person has ever bought it and lived in it, held dinner parties in it, had children in it, and then died there. It was never used as a stable for horses by a nobleman. It was never made into an amusement park centering on the quaint past. It is a shrine, a holy temple, and it always has been. And what makes it a shrine is that Shinto priests maintain it, hold rites in it, clean it, protect it, and every 20 years, lovingly dismantle it and rebuild it anew, fresh, raw, pristine. Trees grown in the generation of the parent temple, trees nourished by the rain that fell on the parent temple, the former temple, nourished by the sunshine that also graced the former temple, those trees are used to rebuild the shrine. And then somewhere between the dismantling and the completed reconstruction, the soul of Issei, Jinju, the shrine, is passed on. So what is it about you that your grandmother loved? What is it that makes you lovable? It's probably not because you tripped grandma at the escalator, or took the biggest piece of cake at her birthday party, or kicked her cat. Yes, your grandma's a little girl, but even jeans can't make a brat adorable. You were grandma's nice little girl. When I was pastor at the First Christian Church in Big Sandy, Texas for 2 years, I attended a spring birthday party in the city park there. Lois Davis was there. She was my oldest member at the time. She's dead now, but she was 86 at the time. When I was leaving the party, she was sitting at a picnic table with a young lady, and she introduced me to this young lady as if she were the Queen of Spain. I don't mean Lois was acting like the Queen of Spain. I mean she introduced me to this young woman as if this young woman were so important. It was her granddaughter. I could see the love that Lois had for her granddaughter, and I could see the love, affection, and concern that was being returned from that young lady. Buddhists do not believe in a permanent self. They see the apparition called self as the mere resemblance of outward form recognized by memory and nothing more. The Buddhists see themselves in the Issei shrine, rebuilt moment to moment. Each time we identify with an appearance of self and turn inward as if there were a boundary between us and those other people out there, each occurrence of that diminishes our opportunities to join the stream of life that never ceases to flow and change around us. Our clutching onto ourselves is like the desperate flailings of a drowning person. Yes, a demonstration of self, but totally ineffective. For the Buddhist, making a splash is not what it's all about. What matters is noiselessly entering the stream and being in flow. And this reminds me very much of a story told by Rachel Naomi Raymond, the doctor, in her great book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. I'm going to tell you that story right now. So what I'm saying isn't about me, it's about her. As an adolescent, I had a summer job working as a volunteer companion in a nursing home for the aged. The job began with a 2-week intensive training about communication with the elderly. There seemed to be a great deal to remember, and what had begun as a rather heartfelt way to spend a teenage summer quickly became a regimented act of techniques and skills for which I would be evaluated by the nursing staff. By the first day of the actual contact, I was very anxious. My first assignment was to visit a 96-year-old woman who had not spoken for more than a year. A psychiatrist had diagnosed her as having senile dementia, but she was not responding to medication. The nurses doubted that she would talk to me, but hoped I could engage her in a mutual activity. I was therefore given a rather large basket of glass beads of every imaginable size and color. We would string beads together. I was to report back to the nursing station in an hour. I did not want to see this patient. Her great age frightened me, and the words senile dementia suggested not only was she older by far than anyone I had ever met, but also she was crazy. Filled with foreboding, I knocked on the closed door of the room. There was no answer. Opening the door, I found myself in a small room lit by a single window which faced the morning sun. Two chairs had been placed by that window. In one sat a very old lady looking out. The other was empty. I stood just inside the door for some time, but she did not acknowledge my presence at all. Uncertain of what to do next, I went to the empty chair and sat down, the basket of beads in my lap. She did not seem to notice that I had arrived. For a while, I tried to find some way to open a conversation. I was painfully shy at the time, which was one of the reasons my parents had suggested I take this job. I would have had a hard time even in less difficult circumstances. The silence in the room was absolute. Somehow, it almost seemed rude to speak. Yet I desperately wanted to succeed in my task. I considered and discarded all the ways of making conversation suggested in the training. None of them seemed possible. The old woman continued to look out the window, her face half hidden from me, barely breathing. Finally, I simply gave up, sat with a basket of glass beads in my lap for an hour. It was quite peaceful. The silence was broken at last by a little bell which signaled the end of the morning activity. Taking hold of the basket again, I prepared to leave. But I was only 14 years old and curious. So I turned to the old woman and I said, "What are you looking at?" I immediately flushed. Prying into the lives of patients was forbidden. Perhaps she'd not heard me, but she had. Slowly, she turned toward me and I could see her face for the first time. It was radiant. In a voice filled with joy, she said, "Why, child, I'm looking at the light." Many years later, as a pediatrician, I would watch newborns look at that light with the same rapt expression, almost as if they were listening for something. A 96-year-old woman may stop speaking because arterial sclerosis has damaged her brain, or she's become psychotic, she's no longer able to speak, but she may also have withdrawn into a space between the worlds to contemplate what is next, to spread her sails, and patiently wait to catch the light. So ends that story. The heart that can catch the light and live forever is equal, in my opinion, to the soul of Issei Shrine. But it must be practiced. The shrine never stops being a shrine because it is filled with shrine activities. The heart that never dies is that heart because it is turned outward toward others, not toward others as opposed to oneself, but toward others as oneself. In the 2nd century AD, the Catholic Church almost elected Valentinus as pope. He came in second, and you know that doesn't count when you're a pope. Too bad, because the Catholic Church, Valentinus was a Gnostic, the Catholic Church would have been changed and Christianity would have been changed forever. You see, Valentinus did not believe in the resurrection from the dead, meaning your body is resurrected. He believed in the resurrection from the dead, a resurrection from the death of self-interest, selfishness, egoism. Those grasping around us, thieves, robbers, politicians, generals, presidents, they are the dead. They gather around themselves wealth, power, and imagine that that will keep death at arm's length or ease somehow the pain of their eventual disappearance. How much better, it seems, would it be that we simply disappear into every moment, disappear into watchfulness, disappear into the non-anxious presence, disappear and be reborn as passers-by, reborn with the heart that never dies. How can one fear a thing that will change nothing? How can death take from us something we have already surrendered? In the movie The Last Samurai, the last scene of the movie is worth the movie itself. Ken Watanabe plays a samurai who teaches a Union soldier, Tom Cruise, the way of Bushido, the way of the warrior. Watanabe is mortally wounded in that last scene and dying on the battlefield. As he slumps into Tom Cruise's arms, he sees his life as one perfect moment after another perfect moment, fully lived, fully realized. The scene then switches to cherry blossoms blowing from an orchard, and the dying samurai whispers, "Each moment perfect. It's all perfect." The 20th century's greatest Protestant theologian, Paul Tillich, summed up his four volumes of theology by saying, "Ultimately, everything's okay." The Apostle Paul echoes similar thoughts when he says, "I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. Death, where is thy sting? Grave, where is thy victory?" So, why did your grandmother love you? Yeah, she saw a nice kid there, but she also saw herself there in you, the rebuilt temple, the home of the heart that never dies.